Okay. Well, welcome to our latest Brown Bag here at our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives. My name is John Beck, and I've been happy to coordinate this series now for 21 years. And so we're, for the most part, midway through fall semester, and we have wonderful Brown Bags just passed, and a wonderful one today and coming forward. So let me just do a commercial for the fact that James DeMonte is with us today, and his book, Brotherhood, he has available. But I wanted to highlight the fact that his book was published by Blue Cubicle Press, which for those of you who read my emails, I often highlight Blue Cubicle Press because of the wonderful job that they do on the things that they publish. So I'm gonna send around three things. They have actually three series. They have a series of independent novels and freestanding books, of which James's book is one. Let me not try to kill myself here. Then they have collections of short stories that are within their series called Workers' Right. So in this case, it's called More Tales from the Cubicle. Their first one was Tales from the Cubicle, so they kind of have gotten around to that. And then in their most flexible series, they run something called Overtime, which are individual small chapbooks that are either pieces of fiction and, in only one case so far, a chapbook of poetry. But the latest one is it's called Overtime, and I love it. They do it that they don't call it version number or issue number, they say hour number. So this is hour number 41 of Overtime at the Wheel of the Western World, Dave Barrett's piece on working a fishing boat in Alaska. And they're fabulous, fabulous things. If you're interested later, I have more information on what they do. Next week, our last October Brown Bag, Lou Martin will be in from Chatham University in West Virginia to talk about Blair Mountain. And Blair Mountain, of course, was one of the major battles of the West Virginia Mine Wars, but it's been at the center of controversy because of the fact that a mining company is looking to actually strip mine the Blair Mountain, but others regard Blair Mountain as a possible heritage site for the U.S. Because of the fact that it was the location of one of the pitched battles of the West Virginia Mine Wars that actually involved around 13,000 miners. And ultimately, those miners were actually bombed by the U.S. Air Force, which tried, it was one of the first times that they decided to try those type of ordnance here in the U.S. Nobody died from the actual bombs that I'm aware of, but people did die in the actual pitched battle between the miners and various gun thugs. So that's coming up next Friday right here, and then we have things throughout the rest of the semester. Well, I'm very happy today to introduce James DeMonte. James is with the English department at Lakeland Community College in Ohio, and is someone who calls upon his own working roots and looks at generally the experience of workers in his fiction. He finished a interesting MFA in relation to the fact that it's shared by a number of universities in Ohio. Ohio University, Kent State, University of Akron, and I'm forgetting, and Youngstown State. And today he's going to read from some of his works, and he's going to talk about the writing of fiction that has to do with labor, which we've titled today Brotherhood, Fiction and the Communion of Labor. So please help me welcome James to our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Well, since this is being recorded just in audio format, I would like to say I've never seen so many people at a reading before. It's standing room only, technically standing room. I appreciate you coming and listening to me read a little bit of my work. And I will get to this, and this will be the bulk of what I read. I had worked on the railroad as a laborer after I had earned a bachelor's of English at Mount Union College, a small liberal arts school in Alliance, Ohio. And as it goes sometimes with liberal arts degrees, I couldn't find much work. And so I did, I had a series of jobs, and I wound up on the railroad doing track maintenance for a little while. But it wasn't the only labor job I had had. I'd worked on county roads and bridges, and I worked at the post office on the docks and so forth. And I thought a lot about those experiences and the camaraderie that exists amongst workers, despite sometimes hard toiling and rough talk. And so I wanted to address that in my fiction. But I set the whole thing on the railroad. And my mom doesn't care for the book very much. She thinks there's some interesting writing, but she said next time to write something that she can share with her friends, because I did want to make the characters as true as I could. And so they are sometimes crude and most of the time rough, at least on the job site. And so before I read my own work, I wanted to read a small passage of work by a poet named Maj Ragan. He is based in Northeast Ohio. He's originally from Southern Illinois, Olney, Illinois. And he has a number of books. This is my favorite, called Fresh Oil, Loose Gravel, Collected Poems. And in it, I can let the work speak for itself, but I think this is a good sort of lead for the kind of characters I'm going to discuss in the way they interact with each other and the way they're able to build brotherhood and camaraderie through, sometimes physically demanding and sometimes rough circumstances. So this is from the middle of Mage's book, and it's called Blue Talk at Ed Brassier's Garage. This is just the opening. Shorty Nettleton has been retired as long as I can remember. I first met him in 1955 when, as a teenage pup, I'd go down to Ed Brassier's Garage on Lafayette Street in Olney just to hear the cussing. It remains to this day the best cussing I ever heard. It was sort of like the Pentecostals speaking in tongues, but there wasn't a word I didn't understand. It was nasty business, I suppose, taking everything in vain, for the earth itself is the Lord's footstool, but so help me, I loved it and still do. They seemed as brave and as free as any men I ever met. It was as if they used to cuss to break the crust that forms around a man's life, theirs, mine. Of course, nothing they did changed the fact that we were all, as Ed would say, fuck tomatoes. So, as a heads up, that's the kind of story that I wrote, I guess, similar characters. So anyway, I'm going to open up with, I'm going to read a handful of kind of vignettes from the book. And it's not a very big book, obviously. It's a novella. It's 100 pages about. But I'm going to read a series of vignettes and kind of jump around. I think they sort of loosely connect. And that's the way I wrote the book, even though it is a linear narrative. Initially, I wrote it as just a bunch of little scenes, and then I kind of moved them around and connected them. So I'm going to start with fairly deep in the book, where the characters are at lunch, and none of them are really given their actual names. Everyone sort of goes by a nickname, and these are all nicknames that are according to the narrator, who himself was a recent college graduate. It's fiction, but it's loosely connected to my own experience. And he himself is called the professor because he has a bachelor's degree, and that part is somewhat autobiographical. Anyway, at lunch, the little fat one was perched on his tie jammer with Greaser, who joined him. He was eating daily doses of bacon, slices that looked a half inch thick. He would tell the butcher, cut them puppies wide, and usually wash them down with Pepto-Bismol. Hey, he called down, I hear you're worried about your balls. As a little bit of exposition, the narrator has expressed his concern that the creosote that he's exposed to every day is said to cause scrotum cancer. I walked up and took off my hard hat. What? I asked. Your balls, he said. worried they're about to fall off or something. Greaser sat with them and coughed a chuckle. I didn't say anything, but couldn't go eat somewhere else now, so I moved in closer. The little fat one went on. You just don't want to be on that broom and you run around screaming to the bosses that your nuts got cancer, huh? Overexposure to creosote, I said, but too quick and in a way that sounded more like a mumble. He cut me off. Hold on. Slow down. Quit eating your words. What are you saying? It's a carcinogen, I said, trying to stretch out consonants and vowels, near perfect enunciation. Overexposure to it can lead to cancer, they say. You ever read a medical journal? Fuck no. Read a medical, what the fuck? I didn't really read them either, just websites sometimes. In high school, he said, I never read books, not one, none of that shit. I was busy chasing tail, see? The old lickety-split. He wagged his tongue fast between his index and middle finger. He started thrusting his hips forward from his seated position and looked toward Greaser, saying, hell yes. Greaser had a slow smile. What are you scared of anyhow, the little fat one said. If you don't even use them, what's the difference? Scrotum cancer, I finally said. That's what it is, as if that would be better. What they say can become. Scrotum, he said, like ball skin. He knew what it was, I think. Yeah, I said, like ball skin. Yeah, he said, they. He slapped at Greaser with faux sincerity. They'll tell you about that and global warming and everything else. Mesothelioma, I had that one down. Who would have thought that asbestos? Wait, he said. Mesa, musa, mucho, what? I don't speak Mexican or Dago Wop-Talk or whatever the hell you are, buddy. No hablo bullshit. I went on as if I was debating in some class, as if it mattered what I said to him. I guess that was the only way to go on, to force out the words regardless if he'd receive them or believe them. This, after all, was for my benefit, not his. A cancer that attacks the lining of the lungs, I said. All those shipmen, construction types, even railroaders, no idea they're exposed to it, and bam. Greaser's smile eased away, and he stayed still. The little fat one leaned back and nodded big. Yeah, there you go, he said. Tell you what, he went on. The best way to avoid getting nut cancer, he said. The absolute best way. He paused so I'd at least widen my eyes to let him know I was hanging on his words. I wouldn't budge, so he said, the best way, you follow me? I still didn't budge. He cupped his hands to his mouth to amplify, leaning forward, almost coaxing me to do the same so that I could hear his solution plain and clear and saying, don't screw the lumber. He sat back, playing off of Greaser's laughter that had snapped back on the lumber part and said, don't fuck it. The little fat one now spoke fully to Greaser. Don't get out and rub your balls all up and down the railroad ties, in other words, he said. He grabbed his crotch on the last part. Looking like some goddamn dog rubbing his ass across the lawn. He smacked Greaser's arm with the back of his hand when he said it, causing Greaser to huh. And now he acted like a dog, lifting his legs up and pretending to rub whatever worms might have been in him on the seat. Greaser joined him now. Matter of fact, Greaser said, I might even suggest not fucking lumber, period, railroad tie or otherwise. Don't use that creosote to jerk off and you'll be A-okay, the little fat one concluded. There was still plenty of lunch left, so he started up to leave. So he started up to leave his machine. He asked, hey, you going over to Pittsburgh for that wreck, are you? There was a wreck on one of the tracks in Pittsburgh, and some of the guys are supposed to go work overtime. The guys who are low on the totem pole, seniority-wise. I hesitated. Well, you going? Yeah, I said. You? Hell no, he said. But it won't be bad, a young fella like yourself. Use MapQuest on the computer. That's what I do. It'll get you there. Hey, between mileage and time and a half, you'll make a lot of money at least. He moved across the machine to step down, and I recognized that our conversation, our give and take, was over. I stepped with one foot off, holding on to the rail. I coughed a bit to clear my throat and put my hard hat back on. He walked down the faded yellow and steel steps, moving past me. As he stepped off, he bopped the top of my hat with his hand, saying, PhD. It's worth noting the character doesn't have a PhD, just graduated college, undergrad is all. I don't know what he meant exactly, but I waited a beat and smacked his belly with my left, catching him with my steel-gloved hand, fingers worn through. Railroad, I said, doing my best to stare at him, but not really at him. He didn't look up and kept walking. It was just Greaser and me now, and we sat in silence for a bit, eating. "That's fucked up," Greaser finally said after taking a bite, ha-hung some more, and gazing off from his seat. He finished first, having eaten some chips, a banana, and most of a bologna sandwich. He took out a non-filter Camel and let it hang from the corner of his mouth. His hands interlocked together on his knees, and he looked to the side of the tracks where he'd just thrown the remnants of his meal, banana peel, potato chip bag, and all. The way he sat, the way he concentrated on nothing and everything, it looked like he was shitting. All right, so that's, I think that gives you a good sense of anyway, the way the characters communicate with each other a lot throughout the book. But I'm going to jump around a little bit now, and the story, the narrative is character driven, and so I just hoping today I can introduce you to a number of the characters, and there, that was a couple of them. A little later on, workday is finished, and the narrator is walking to his car. "I walked to my Grand Prix when we got back. The scrotum cancer cracks had ceased as soon as the men all jumped into their mostly domestic pickups to race home, having checked out of the motel already. My seat was still reclined from my morning wait. I turned the key and there was nothing. My cabin light had been left on. It was a foggy dark when I had arrived to work, and with the several minutes I had spent reading the Hightower Lowdown, I used the light and forgot to turn it off when I got started with Satchel." Satchel's the foreman. "Kentucky pulled up alongside me in his Earnhardt Camaro." This is a guy who has a Camaro. He's invested a lot of money in to look like a replica of Dale Earnhardt's race car. "His Earnhardt Camaro that he only drove on Thursday/Fridays, they work 4/10, so it's really Thursday, but they call it Friday, when rain wasn't in the forecast. He rolled down the window. 'What do you need, Professor, a jump?' 'I think so,' I said. 'Professor, Professor, Professor,' he said. He made a big U-turn in the gravel lot. Typically, there wasn't much room to maneuver one's vehicle, parking alongside tracks in the yard, but we'd been blessed with some space at this spot. He pulled up front bumper to front bumper, got out and asked, 'Well, you got your cables?' He stood with his thumbs and forefingers holding the straps of his bib overalls. 'I don't think so,' I said. He shook his head and bopped back to his trunk. 'Professor, Professor, Professor,' he said. He came back around with the jumpers. He had me hold one end, saying, 'Now, I don't know what they taught you in the Ivy League.'" The character didn't go to the Ivy League. "'But don't let the red touch the black.' Once saw a fellow's pecker blow clear off when he slipped up. He placed the positive and negative clips on his vehicle's battery, grabbed my end, and said, 'All right, look into my car.' I got in, popped my hood, got out, and had trouble with finding the latch to release it. He put his hands to my chest, moving me back, giving me the jumpers, and taking my place. He smirked and opened the hood, took the jumpers back and clamped them on, saying, 'Gotta keep the black grounded.' And then started his car and waited several minutes. He got back out and said, 'Give her a go.' I turned the key, my driver's door still open. It started up. 'When's the last time the battery's been changed?' he asked. I jumbled some kind of response. 'Probably need to get a new one,' he said. 'Go to AutoZone and get this puppy tested. Might be cracked or something.' He took the jumpers off both ends. I didn't want to tell him I had left the light on, but he might have known. 'Now let her run a while,' he said. 'Don't go shutting her off right away.' I had a 2-hour trip home, I told him. I thanked him and started to get out to shake his hand. 'Forget it,' he said, and pushed my door shut. He leaned down to the window. 'To hell with that creosote. It's terrible.'" And this guy, I forgot to mention, the narrator works at the back of the tie repair crew, where he operates a machine called the broom that is constantly kicking up dust, and that's all he's breathing in. So it's the dirtiest job on the tie gang. And he's new and young and low on the totem pole, and that's why he has that job. "It's terrible," Kentucky said. "That's why nobody takes the broom. That and every other shit particle you're breathing in. I told you your first day on the job to stay away from it, and look what you gone and done. Now, I never went to college and never studied cancer or scrotums, at least up close, but I do know anything that's black as hell and burns as soon as it touches your skin ain't no damn good." He sized me up and said something like he'd been saving it. "Look, you're Italian and big and half-strapping, moderately fit, I guess. Two or three generations back, your ass would have been off the boat and on the tracks or in the mines or in the foundry, soon as you could have said, "Buongiorno, Uncle Sam," and none of that National Honor Society shit in between. He reached in and grabbed my shoulder and continued while pointing at me with his free hand. "You got a degree, so you need to get another and another and another and another and another until you stop breaking your back. If that don't work, get another." He patted the sill of my car's door and said, "See you Monday." All right, so that's Kentucky, the character, I'd say, to whom the narrator's the closest and with whom he works the most. And now I'm going to jump around to a couple other spots to give you a sense of the other characters and some of the work they do. There's a character named G.I. Jane. It's a guy who is in the ROTC as a college student, became an Iraq War veteran, and got hired on in a supervisor position on the railroad because he had a degree. And he's about half the age of a lot of his subordinates. So they call him G.I. Jane. It's a pejorative. When we trammed out, G.I. Jane was waiting and informed us that some freight was coming through. And rather than wait, we were heading over to Shipman's Crossing to replace anchors, which kept the rail from moving in bad heat. This was an executive decision, and the men knew it was bullshit. It wasn't in G.I. Jane to be a slouch. He bubbled with energy and wanted work. He'd make the most efficient use of time. We reboarded and were told we'd be back later to finish the ties. I went with the little fat one, and we didn't say a word to each other. I hooked my arms in the steel on the machine so that I wouldn't fall off if I fell asleep. Even though we hadn't worked at all that day, I did just that, sitting on the steps to his tie jammer. We'd hit a bump, and my head would pop up as if attached by a spring. I woke and saw the little fat one staring on 1,000 yards. We both wore sunglasses, and for all I knew, he could have been sleeping too. When we came to railroad crossings, it often meant that we were passing through towns. They knew every town in northern Ohio, what specialties the little corner stores served, whether they had homemade root beer floats or good donuts. It also meant people would pass by in these small towns that weren't small towns anymore, just skeletons, with the closest the industrialized centers 30 or 40 miles off. There was generally a rusted out town square through which we would pass, and oftentimes there were men and women walking, old-timers mostly, on the broken sidewalks. They'd wave sometimes, and at first I'd wave too. I took to nodding before long and eventually just looking up. These exposures to civilization were once every few days or maybe just once a week. Most of the storefronts in places like Sherrodsville and Fallen Timbers were vacant. The even smaller burgs like Peaks Hollow had a filling station but no pumps left behind. Their hide points had been a half century ago, after the war but before interstate highways and free trade. If general stores still had a heartbeat and the day done, trainmen would have a chance to run to gather moon pies, star cakes, and hot peppered beef jerky, and if they were lucky, an ice cream cone. Satchel, diabetic and all, usually had a package of each. On the way to Shipman's, he stopped at Wilma's Deli for breakfast since he rode toward the top and had some moments to spare. He had a ham, egg, and cheese, and bacon sandwich. Kentucky reported that he also ate a large dish of apple pie a la mode, crushing it up to look like a chunky soup, but lamenting the store-bought taste. Kentucky had gone with him to pay and told me he fell asleep right there at the register, standing up. Narcoleptic asshole. Otherwise, traveling down tracks all day, you don't see too much. The rails stretch for miles through wood and debris. They stretch and stretch, and sometimes you can't see anything at all off in either direction. You could have binoculars and you'd see the same thing. What it must be like, I thought, stare on and not be able to see anything at the other end. You might go over a bridge, which makes your stomach twist if you look down, with the gaps between ties and all. But you get used to it. On a given day, the gray of the rock, the brown of the earth, and the rust of the rail blend together as if on a palette, oil paints mixed up for consistent dullness. It was a treat to come on a town, dead or alive. When they would pass us by, there'd be color, bright or sad, and there'd be people. We got to Shipman's, and it started to rain cold, steady drops. I put some yellow plastic over my body and wore safety goggles in place of my sunglasses. I reminded myself of Alvaro Espinosa, the Cleveland Indians utility infielder from the mid-90s glory years who wore thick goggles on the field. Mine got misty, having trapped in sweat and steam. I imagine having little windshield wipers placed in them, like I had seen in some movie or cartoon. We carried buckets of new anchors, pounding out the old and popping new ones in. It usually took me two hits, one to set the anchor and the next to knock it in place. They looked like thick, fat hooks that fit on the bottom of the track and needed fixed to the sides of the plates with the sledge's force. We smacked them and walked, smacked them and walked. It took Kentucky one hit generally. I was blasting one about three or four times, including an all-out miss, and Kentucky placed his hand on my chest, pushing me back, singing, "'Cause you can't replace a steel-driving man," and situating the anchor with force. Sometimes there'd be a spike missing or not in all the way. You'd have to put a new one in or nail the old one back down. As Kentucky would, he'd sing more, but to himself, "We was born for driving steel." At lunch, Kentucky told me about his in-laws who owned a carry-out pizza parlor on the Ohio River. His wife was half Italian, and according to Kentucky, cousins with anyone whose last name had at least five vowels. He was hoping to move full-time into the pizza business so he wouldn't have to spend another winter on the tracks. "Now, I don't want you to get all sore," he said, "because you think that white people can't make pizza pie." I didn't eat much pizza, and had always figured I was white. "It's good," he said. "I'm telling you, it's good. Blow your college-educated mind." Lunch ending, I walked over to some weeds to take a leak. I was midstream before realizing I was knee-deep in poison ivy, and I stumbled back, pissing just a bit on my jeans. I zipped up, drank some water, intentionally spilled a little down my pant leg for cover. I turned and rejoined Kentucky. He grabbed our sledges, and he slapped my shoulder, saying, "Happens to the best of us," and winking. The clouds were clearing away, and Kentucky and I walked under a magnolia in bloom. We both stopped and looked up, squinting, sweat stinging our eyes. "What do you think it'd be like to be all the way up there?" I asked, "the top branches." He leaned on his sledge and kept looking. Some time went by. Finally, I told him, "I figure I'd keep on floating up and up, forever up." He didn't move at all and said, "I'd probably have a 3-day boner." That's Kentucky for you, always bringing it back to basics. We stayed on anchor several more hours and never did get back to tie replacement, despite clear weather. After, we tram back machines we'd never used, having to settle for a day's worth of anchor pay. All right, a couple more little sections. All right, so I mentioned the characters work in this machine called the broom, and this is kind of close to the end of the book. All right, the broom went off track. Stopping would be bad enough when the broom's still on track. Then it would be just a matter of time before Greaser could jimmy it back for me. At worst, I could have called one of the electricians using the little fat one CB. The machine's too heavy to muscle it back, though I still tried. What you need are spud bars, jacks, and about four guys. That's what it would take. Greaser, G.I. Jane, Shifty, and me. Iron Mike and Kentucky had problems of their own lifting the rails to slide the plates just into place on this resistant stretch. Greaser stopped his spiker, and Shifty did the same behind him. They passed the rail lifters, came up, and then it called to me or looked bewildered. Greaser's boots cut through the rock just as if he were walking to eat his lunch. Shifty's body came up quick, his feet barely hitting the ground. All the while, I pushed with my arms, trying to move tons of steel like it was a small four-cylinder car stuck in a dry ditch and revving. Greaser moved past me and placed his left palm on my back as he did. Whether he was telling me not to fret or to simply get out of his way, I don't know. We went to the right side of the broom where the switches were and studied them. Shifty stood beside me and looked on. Greaser kept flicking the broom on and off as if the ignition would get it back on track. He had to know that it wouldn't and couldn't. He continued, though, until G.I. Jane pulled his utility truck up alongside the broom. Shifty must have radioed him. Greaser had known this C-rate machine for the better part of the decade. He used to work it himself. G.I. Jane had never worked any of these machines, and he made twice as much money as any of us. What have we got here?" he asked. Greaser turned the switches and knobs and even tugged on the choke, pushing and pulling it in vain for several more seconds. "Need to get her back on track," Greaser said, blowing camel smoke and finally turning from the broom switchboard. G.I. Jane put his hands on his hips. "All right," he said. He looked determined but confused. Shifty leaned in and told me that G.I. Jane was a post turtle. "A post turtle?" I asked, both of us turning our backs. "You mean tell me you don't know what a post turtle is?" Shifty said low. "A turtle sitting on top of a post. Don't know how it got there, don't know how it's going to get down. All it knows is it's on a post, and that's about it." With the broom off the track and him as supervisor, G.I. Jane looked like a post turtle indeed, albeit a resolute one. "Well, let's get it going," he said. Greaser said, "All right." He said it almost like a Scotsman, pronouncing the all as ah, like a yawn, and hammering down the rolling ard right. Shifty leaned over again, saying, "Don't worry, man, I've screwed that spiker up something awful." He knocked his head with his knuckles. "I'm like a damn Neanderthal on these machines." Kentucky blamed foreigners. Satchel blamed liberals. Greaser blamed blacks. I blamed the wealthy. Shifty never blamed anyone but himself. If G.I. Jane's plain white t-shirt sleeves weren't short, he would have rolled them up. He came on with vigor that was out of place. He'd try one thing and Greaser would say, "Don't do that." He'd try something else, and Greaser never broke monotone stride. That either. He had probably been a good soldier, G.I. Jane. He was just stuck on a post was all. We worked on it, and Shifty cranked like a madman. He bounced up and down with a spud bar. Greaser worked the jacks, G.I. Jane did what Greaser told him, and I didn't do much of anything, though I wanted to. As the broom jacked up and we all worked, it only moved an inch at a time, it seemed. Sorry, it seemed like an hour to get it back on track, but it hadn't even been close. After I said thanks and tried to restart it, it turned over and fired, but it wouldn't sweep. There were just about 70 ties left in the day, and per Greaser's advice, G.I. Jane told me not to bother calling the electricians, because by the time they could get to it to get the bristles moving again, the day would be over. Since the equipment was so beat up, no one even mentioned that it could have been my fault. They all left but G.I. Jane. He, for his post-turtle syndrome, never came down hard on any man there. In Iraq, he could. He was in his 20s, and most of his subordinates were 18 and 19. He'd have to hear eventually, he probably knew, but he was learning on the job. When the broom can move but not sweep, that means a couple of things. You have to keep it on and make sure it moves down track at a reasonable pace, not too fast and not too slow, turning the knobs on the side. You also have to remove the gravel by hand with a short-handled flathead shovel like those used for cement, making sure no rocks are in the way for the men lifting the rail to slide the plates fully in or the ones driving spikes at the end of the gang. Sometimes, I swore, the broom would pick up speed on its own. Kentucky would holler up to me, "You got a runaway broom, Professor," if I hadn't noticed it taking off. Iron Mike might say, "Make sure you set the speed, there are knobs on the side." He'd be sincere, too, like I had never worked the broom before. Shoveling the track and placing plates by hand is a two-man job, no question. Since I was the only broomman there, G.I. Jane stuck around with me a while longer. I'd shovel as fast as I could, and he kept placing plates. At first, he kept pace all right, but I could see irritation brewing, and then epiphany. He was a supervisor. "One of those guys sitting around up front ought to be back here," he said. After all, the spike pullers were finished by now. He went on a minute or two, confronting those at the front without them being there to hear it. "If those fellows ever are just sitting around like that, I mean it. Get them to come back and help you. You can tell them I told you to." "Okay," I said. I couldn't even see that far up the tracks. All right, and then I'm going to read just one more small section out of this novella. All right, and so two characters I'd mentioned, I guess, were Greaser and Shifty. And, this is primarily with Shifty, I guess. The guys who operate the broom's toward the end of the tie gang, sweeps the tracks, and then behind that a little ways are the spikers who drive the new spikes in, and those two guys work the spikers. The day went normally, and we mostly finished on time. Shifty and Greaser would alternate taking the front or rear spiker. Greaser was in the back and having terrible trouble catching up. Shifty got a big kick out of that and flipped both middle fingers to him after he finished. Greaser responded in kind. Shifty came to me, excited that payday was coming. He was married with two little girls, one to his wife and one to his ex-girlfriend from high school. He had full custody. 6 and 7, they were first graders both, because the older one had to repeat kindergarten. He said that about 5 years before, he made the most money he'd ever made, both on the railroad and in his life. He had worked overtime like crazy. They had us out, they had us out there all day and night that summer, he said. Stayed clear and hot all summer, and them bastards squeezed every last drop out of me that summer, man. Shifty was animated, just like when he'd swing his sledge. When he said squeeze, he wrung his hands together like he had a washcloth in them, gritting all his teeth. He stopped, though, shifting between animation and now some stone-cold seriousness. He looked at me with big eyes and said, tell you what, though, just because of that summer, I made... He stopped to think about it, cracking a fart and using some calculator in the sky. He began again. I made $32,000 that year. Take home. He stepped back and hit me on the chest lightly with the backs of his fingertips, as if to say, huh, how about that? I raised my eyebrows up and said, really? More out of obligation than surprise. He looked off, thinking back and saying, bought a hot tub too, jacuzzi. He grabbed me and said, jacuzzi? Sounds like one of them Italiano ladies. He shook his right hand up at me. We were practically paisans. How many ties do you think we put in on any given day, I asked, though I had kept counts in my head. On a day like today, he said, probably 400 or 500, summertime. Maybe 6 on a good day and 3 on the hard ground. He went on to recount that the same summer responsible for his over $40,000 gross salary, the company men offered the train men free lunches if they could hit 1,000 ties every day over an entire work week. They did it too, he said. Subway sandwiches for every man on Friday. He meant Thursday and held his hands out, saying, those big old cocksuckers too, everything on them. His hands looked like they were about a foot apart, and his whole body shook with some kind of machismo. The company had bought $5 foot-long submarine sandwiches, like advertised on television. They'd squeezed out twice the work from the men for 50 or more hours that four-day work week and repaid them with an Abe Lincoln's worth of hoagie. Shifty showed up to every union meeting, I guess, but he might as well have been a full-fledged company man. The most money I would make in a week was coming up on the next paycheck, where after taxes and union dues had been taken out, it would be just over $700 between overtime, C-rate pay, and mileage at 47 cents a mile, putting me on a long track to match Shifty's personal record. We worked a lot of overtime the two previous weeks, and since I was a broom man, I was making the C-rate always, which was $2.15 more on the hour than my starting wage. Every maintenance of way crewman there operated some machine or other, and they all made $2 to $3 more on the hour because of it. I was surprised, though, to learn that even as a yet-to-be union rookie, I was only a handful of dollars off of Shifty in Kentucky. Make sure you mark down all that overtime, they'd say. When I'd leave to go to my car, I'd hear a chorus of, you mark down that overtime for today? Make sure you get it. Satchel was foreman, and he decided in the end how much overtime we could write in. If we worked an hour and 20 minutes over, he'd tell us whether we could mark 1.5 hours or 2. Every once in a while, if you had to work through your lunch to help with something, anything, Satchel would tell you to mark down an hour overtime on top of the day in place of the half-hour break you missed, which might have been in the contract for all I know. Time and a half was the rate. Satchel moseyed to us but looked at me. Get all your overtime filled in, have you? Yes, I said. We were an hour over that day, thanks to Greaser's slow spiking. Between overtime and mileage, he squinted and asked, you never stay at the motel, do you? No, this meant I was paid mileage every workday. Oh, baby, Satchel said, you're going to make out like a bandit. His smile was jolly and genuine. How old are you? 22, I reminded him. Oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit, he said, as if Christmas morning. Oh, shit. He kept smiling. 22 years old and $600 or $700 in your pocket. A pause for effect, pointing to, now slowing down, don't spend it all on women, you understand? I nodded. Yeah, that's not too bad, I said. Hell no, he got serious. I'd say it's not. Jolly again. Man, they're going to have to take you out of here with your hands behind your back. He crossed his arms behind him and waddled around, nearly tripping over the tracks. I guess he was showing me what a bandit whose cop might look like when cuffed. Satchel was so big that his arms almost didn't reach, and the way he bounced, the way his belly hung out, looking like a thick white belt, some sort of flotation device, it was kind of pitiful. He was happy for me that week, though, and I couldn't help but be thankful and happy, too. All right, so that's everything I'm going to read from that that book. And I think I'm going to just I'll read maybe one more thing. And so, as I mentioned in that book, it was certainly, you know, me working on the railroad. I mean, that part was autobiographical, although I, you know, basically created the characters, and some of them are certainly inspired by real people that I knew and worked with, or combinations of people like that. But really, in my own life, I'm not that far removed from the kind of people that I was writing about there. I mean, certainly I grew up amongst in a working class area, amongst plenty of people who fit some of those descriptions. So here's another piece that is not exactly autobiographical, but is based pretty closely on the kind of place that I come from. And so it takes place in a workplace, although the narrator is not the person working. It's called The Tire Lady of Possum Run Road. To get to the Tire Ladies, you turn off 250 East, out Possum Run Road, not far from Cowboy Hill. You'll go for a while before you see the big tractor tires down by the mailbox, the way some people set wagon wheels or cement lions on either side of a lane. That's where my father buys all his tires. Only one lady is left, the other retired, but let's go see the tire ladies, he still says. Any standard tire is $25. Studded for the snow, run 40 to 60, generally. This late afternoon, a cold, bright day now fading, we're going, my dad and I, to pick up snow tires for his Dodge half ton. A couple miles out Possum Run, you'll find her. The gravel lane runs up to a four-stall garage. Tires are strewn in stacks out back, and a German shepherd pup dances free. Before we're fully out of the truck, I ask, is this the woman who tries to save you? To save you? Saves you money, my dad says. The tire lady is butch cut, short, and well-worn. She looks us both over before asking what she can do for us. She wears a cap with Valvoline printed on it. My dad pulls out a paper scrap, neatly scrawled on with the precision of a carpenter's hand, and asks if she has the 185/70/14s. Just two is all, studded for the weather if she's got them. She looks at him, at the truck, at me, and says, I'll get you close if I don't. She walks off, pointing to a table along the wall and saying, donuts. My dad tells me that German Shepherd is a good dog before he bends to pet it, which he doesn't say often, having carried mail as long as he did. She inspects several tires in the far end of the garage, mumbling about the tread before settling on a couple. How about these, she says, holding them high, one in each hand, her back to us. She turns around with her mismatched set, one for 40 and one for 50, she says. My dad looks them over, looks close at what he has on the truck, takes out a Lincoln penny, measures the tread on all of them, and agrees to buy. He wants his rear tires moved to the front, he says, and this new used set placed on the back, his Dodge a rear wheel drive. She can keep the front two leftovers after. Inside the garage, there is a Confederate flag hanging on the back wall, white painted cement block, with an eagle in the middle of it. There are signs posted too, one with the Ten Commandments, one that says, a husband is proof that a wife can take a joke, another with the 23rd Psalm, one saying, don't tread on me. The tire lady brings around air jacks and blocks. We set to put up the front end of the truck first to take off the tires and hold the Dodge steady. She hands my dad a wrench, and he'll do a good bit of the work. I'll just move the blocks in and out of place. My dad's knees aren't great, and I don't suspect the tire ladies are either, but they'll do most of the work, I know. Did you see that sun come up this morning? She asks, as we all look at the truck, not each other. No, my dad says, I didn't. I shake my head. Always make time for the sunrise, she says. We take off the passenger side and then the driver's, all of us saying little except to ourselves. We make sure the truck is good and steady on the blocks up front. We go to the back now to get those tires off too, so to move them up front. We jack it up and get them down, the passenger's, then the driver's side. I roll the tires up once free, lifting each into place. My dad bolts the nuts tight, while the tire lady takes the rubber off the old front rims with a bead breaker. She then hoists either the $40 or $50 stud tire, I can't tell the difference, up to balance it out on the rim, placing a weight here or there until all is level. She holds the weights she isn't using in her teeth. When I saw that sunrise, she says, I knew trouble was on its way. My father was a sailor and taught me about the pink skies in the morning. Mine had too, though never a sailor. I knew it was trouble, she went on. I was never so troubled by a sunrise. She puts air in the tire and rolls it towards my dad, who puts it on the back end. I watch the sun rise up every morning, she says, to know what's coming for the day. She spits on the ground and begins balancing the second tire. Never saw one like that, though. My dad finishes bolting. He wipes his chin with a handkerchief and tells me the German Shepherd got him while he was squatted down by the tire. But I knew it'd be okay, knew there'd be no trouble, the tire lady says. She smiles big and swings her head back and forth a few times. See, I dropped to my knees, prayed a humble prayer for just a minute or two. I asked the Lord to go forth with his plans for the day. But I asked him for forgiveness. I asked him to give us all another chance. She looks at me now. I asked him for mercy before judgment. Then I knew everything was going to be okay. I knew today would be a good day after those prayers, and it has been, you notice. It has been a good day, my dad says, getting the last tire from her and putting it up, saying nothing else. She comes around and eyeballs the rear driver's side when he finishes. I only have 5 lug nuts for that one, my dad says. He hands her the wrench before he and I move the blocks and release the truck back down with the jacks. You go to church, she asks, after the truck's ready, wiping her hands with an old rag and looking at me again. St. Mary's, my dad says, for the both of us, though I haven't lived in Denison for a while. Catholics. She smiles a half smile now. Catholics, my dad says. You're Italian, the tire lady says, though I don't know if she has asked or told. Italian, my dad says. My ex-husband was Italian, she says, his old man off the boat. His people would come here for the coal, like everybody else, she says and throws the rag to the ground. He was a son of a bitch, my husband, a real bastard, mean as sin. She grabs a tablet and pen. But it ain't the Italian in him that did it. She looks at my dad, then at me, the same way she'd looked the truck over. It was the devil, who can get into anybody. Catholics, Italians, old American Christian broads like me, even anybody. That's where prayer comes in, she says. That's where the Spirit comes in, to beat back the devil. But he's a tricky bastard, ain't he? Sure is, my dad says, grabbing his wallet from his back pocket. Hides in everything, she says, just waiting to get at you, in whiskey, in automobiles even. She flips open the tablet and laughs, money especially. She begins to write out my dad's slip and stops, looking me hard in the eye. Truth is, my old man never would have hit me, never would have done any of the terrible things he did to me or his daughters or anyone. Wouldn't it have been for the devil. He's dead and gone now, my husband, but I pray for his soul still. You Catholics got purgatory, and I'm not Catholic, I'm Christian. But my husband was born Catholic, so I believe he's there in purgatory, waiting, and I keep praying. 10 years ago, I turned all over to the Lord, turned it all over to him, and I've been fine since. She finishes the slip and hands it to my dad. My dad smiles kindly, gives her 90 in cash, 3 20s and 3 10s, and pets the dog. We appreciate it, he says. Take a donut, she says. We do. It's going to be a good evening for you boys, she says. We get in the cab and back out of the driveway, my dad smiling still, happy for this woman of God, I suppose, for German Shepherd pups, for purgatory, for cheap tires. We drive a short while, saying nothing, out the half-paved country highway, which bends tightly back and forth like a half-coiled snake, watching the sun set over the coal hills along Possum Run. Some sunset, my dad finally says. It's something, I say. These tires, he says, they're practically new. That's the tire lady. And I guess I've got a few, I'm just going to read one more short one because it's one I really like. And it also speaks to the kind of place that my family wound up a couple of generations back. This is called Tiendas Latinas. Go to a Latin corner store in eastern Ohio and understand the other patrons are Guatemalan, not Mexican like the store owner, and certainly not Italian like you. Buy a glass bottle of Pepsi, since you can't find them like that anymore. Consider that someone with your same blood might have busted one like it over a scab's head some decades past, and understand that the Guatemalans at the chicken farm are organizing today. Imagine the bottle's writing were in Sicilian. Wonder if there's still a deposit on these. That's what your grandfather might have wondered had he lived to enter Bodega Mexicana. Ask the clerk, ¿Puedo practicar español? When he responds, can I practice my English? Continue in your first language. Tell him that you enjoy his store, that you're reminded of other import stores in coal towns nearby that have been there half a century and are run by very old men, that Eastside Imports is operated by a Greek, and that the original owner, a paisano of your grandfather, who had a name like Salvatore or John Mario or Carmine, was in prison for killing a man with a pickaxe. Say, that man had it coming. Try telling him all that in Spanish. Las tiendas de importación. Notice how he minds his store and not your stressed syllables. A woman comes and points to phone cards. Guatemala, the clerk asks her, grabbing a card, gracias. When she walks to Las Frutas, he tells you hers is really a Mayan tongue. Lock eyes with Pope Francis against the wall beside the lotto tickets. Try again. ¿Eres tu católico? Obviously, sí. Ask, ¿es la otra gente latina aquí católica también? And then try to remember the last time you felt a rosary, or confessed your sins, or even genuflected. When he shrugs, drink from your bottle and decide whether or not his was an English or a Spanish shrug. A lot have become evangelical, he finally says. Palm a soccer ball at the front and ask about deportes if he plays them. This time his no will be plain American English. Start to exit and see the Mayan woman's little girls, probably 4 and 3, and with names like Rosa or Mariana or Liliana, pull on their mother's dress and point to dulces. Bend, smile, and say hola, waving your fingers. Watch them turn away, back into their mother, her palate of a face not cracked. Leave and finish what's left of the Pepsi, still searching for something forever gone, looking off beyond dead clay hills in the distance. All right. That's it. Thank you for listening.
Talk a little bit about the work, and especially about why focus this way in your fiction, say, rather than a lot of other choices that you might have been able to make.
I guess, there's the adage, and you'll hear this in writing workshops all the time, write what you know. But I think building off of that, write from a particular place. And I think that's what's going to speak to people and make people connect in some kind of universal way when you write from a specific, particular place, whether you're writing fiction or whatever you're writing. And this is the place I was from. These are the people I knew, and these were the particulars of my life. I like to write fiction because I like the freedom of it. But I like telling stories about people who have been so important to me, even if they're not the specific characters that show up in my fiction. I think the underlying truth is the same. And so I think a lot about, I'm a couple of generations in, so I'm removed. But I think a lot about the way my grandparents and great-grandparents' generation wound up in eastern Ohio, and the kind of work they did, the kind of jobs they had that have led to my generation being able to go to college and sort of move beyond that. And so, I don't know if it's some sort of familial obligation that I feel to share that story, whether it's, I have another novella that's unpublished, I'm trying to get published, that's about an older, a retired coal miner named Louis Dominic. Luciano Dominici was his given name, and he winds up in a nursing home, and the stories take place when he's about 90 years old. And so, that's not an exact biography of my grandmother's brother, a great uncle of mine, but it is a is some kind of homage to him, I think, from me. You know, he was like another grandparent to me. And so the character is one I guess I made, but it tells a lot of his story. And I guess that's kind of a rambled response, but I think it comes down to me wanting to write about a particular place that I know well. And I think if readers are going to connect to anything that I write, it's going to be when I make it as genuine and as particular as I can.
Okay, let me open up to other people if they have students. Dorothy?
I'm just curious. You're coming through a part where you use the word post-turtle. Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
Is that slow man?
What's, sorry?
What does that mean?
Oh, post-turtle. Well, that's what where he says he's a post-turtle, and the character says, where he said, you don't know what a post-turtle is? And the narrator says, no, I don't. What is it? And he says, it's a turtle sitting on a post. Doesn't know how it's got there. Doesn't know how it's going to get down. All it knows is it's on a post, and that's about it. And that's why he's referring to the supervisor as a post-turtle. How'd he get there? He doesn't know, but he's up on a post, and he doesn't know how he's going to get down. And so that was, to tell you where that came from, there's a poet, maybe John knows of her, I don't know, Maggie Anderson, and she ran the Wick Poetry Center at Kent State. She's retired now. I had Maggie as a professor. She taught this multi-genre workshop. And so I was a fiction writer, but I took this course with her even though she was a poet, teaching this multi-genre workshop. And she was reading some of my stories, and she told me she spent most of her life in West Virginia, and until she came to Ohio. And she told me some story about people using the phrase post-turtle. And she got a big kick out of it the first time she heard it. So she grew up in West Virginia, but she just, I think, had heard that in her adult life from somebody.
Well, does it mean slow?
I think it means the guy's, he's in this post as a supervisor, and he has no idea what to do.
So I think it's clueless. I mean, the person is really clueless.
Yeah,
really,
I guess
clueless
would be the word for it, yeah. But it's just the idea of somebody who has no idea how to operate in this foreign place, and they're stuck. And so, anyway, that's, yeah.
Well, let me ask you the natural question that arises out of the first part of Brotherhood that you read, which is that, you know, I mean, often it's been said that that workplaces, male-dominated workplaces, are full of salty language and and everything else. And since we've heard a lot about that lately in the presidential campaign, you know, what often is called locker
room. I was thinking about that as I was prepping for this reading.
Locker room talk.
Right.
Now, the question I would raise is what do you think, I mean, is it, do people bring that with them and therefore, you know, have permission to have it expressed there, or do you think that it's part of the environment of being in fairly tough manual work that creates, you know, that? And
in my experiences in those sorts of environments, I think it's a combination of things. I think for some people it's a way to blow off steam. I think for other people, it's an opportunity to be completely juvenile and offensive if they're seeking that outlet. I think for some, it's when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You know, I mean, I think I knew people on jobs, and I'm not a long-term laborer by any means, but I worked in it to. I quit the railroad whenever I found out I had a graduate assistantship. I knew I had gotten into graduate school. I didn't know I had any assistantship. And I thought I might be here for a little while. I found out I had funding. And so I said, well, good, this is an opportunity to move on. But I knew, I knew people who I suspect would have, and it wasn't, of course, every person I worked with. But people who did talk like that, I suspect they wouldn't have talked like that in the rest of their day-to-day life outside of the workplace. And sometimes it was offensive and bigoted and misogynistic and racist and everything else. I'm not defending it by any means. And I think people come at it in different ways. I think some people, there was a saltiness about them because there was a saltiness to who they were, and sometimes there was venom in the way they would talk, especially when it would come to sexist, racist kind of stuff that some people might use in those situations. And there are others who I think were just having good fun. And that's why I read that part of that poem by Madge Reagan, where he talked about, you know, the way that those guys in the garage that he knew talked to, as he put it, break off the crust that forms around, the hardened crust that forms around you over time. And so, you know, I don't think there's a good answer for it. You mentioned, you know, current presidential politics. Certainly that, you know, I think sometimes in the way people talk, and again, I'm not defending any of the characters in my book by any means, because it's a lot of it is offensive. But I think sometimes there's more venom in it than other times, more maliciousness. And sometimes it's for the sake of being ironic or ridiculous and having fun as well. So.
Okay.
You mentioned your mother's reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
Would she challenge you on the authenticity of the characters?
Oh, no, she wouldn't. She was just not at all, right? And she, yeah, you know, I think it was just a little rough for her, and I get that. And I'll defend her in that, you know, I was talking with John before I started about a writer named Donald Ray Pollock, if anybody knows him or not. He's a contemporary writer, middle-aged, and he retired somewhat early from the Mead paper plant in Chillicothe, which John knows. And he accumulated some degrees after his early retirement. I think he had initially dropped out of high school, so apparently, you know, got a GED or something along the way. And Pollock has a book called Knock 'em Stiff. And there's a tiny little town outside Chillicothe actually called Knock 'em Stiff. And, you know, I don't know if it has even 1,000 people. And so it's not really a town, it's a holler, he calls it. And that book is discomforting and raw, certainly. And I liked the whole thing. The second story was so much so, out of about 10 stories, I think, that I've never finished it. Because I thought, I recognized some good writing in it. It's called Dynamite Hole. I like Pollock as a writer. There was some interesting, it was an interesting narrative, interesting turns of phrase. But I just wasn't in a place where I felt like finishing that story for what was taking place in it. And I think my mom had a similar experience with, she was torn. She wanted to read it because I had written it, and she did read it. And she said there was a lot she liked in it, but it was just a little too much for her, so I can appreciate that.
What reaction have you had from people similar to those you depicted in the book?
Well, think about that. I guess, I mean, you know, when you work with a small press and you have there's a small distribution of your books, generally people who read it are going to be people who know you or have come to a reading like this, right, and get a copy of it. And they tend to be complimentary, whether, I assume it's genuine, but I think part of it that comes into it is them knowing me or having met me at a reading like this. And so.
Well, let me recast Bill's question in a different way, though, which is, have you shared it? Do you find yourself sharing work with people who, in effect, are the ones that you're reflecting in your fiction? Are you sharing your fiction with those, for example, for whom, you know, with whom you worked on the railroad? And would you, and what kind of reaction do you think you would have gotten if you were sharing it?
You know, I think it depends. Generally speaking, if I shared it with people who like worked, and I have shared fiction with people that I've worked with, not this specific book, because I've been in academia since, you know, for a while, and so I don't have the workplace contact, but you know, a guy who works at a chemical plant in labor in Willoughby, Ohio, outside of Cleveland, a retired steel worker from Warren. I'm just thinking of some people, Warren near Youngstown, some people I know who have read it, have said, again, they're complimentary and they're people I know, but have told me they think it's, sort of interesting and true to those sorts of places. My brother's worked jobs like these as well, and they've read them, although they're not career guys on the railroad or on the bridges or anything like that. But in terms of just other fiction I've shared about the place that I come from, I think people have appreciated that I've, to some degree, that I've been trying to share that place, that particular place, in through fiction. And so I'm certainly willing to, but to go back to the way, I guess what you asked and the way you recast it, specifically the guys I worked with on the railroad, I have a feeling some would get a kick out of it. Some would see themselves in some of the characters and not like it. And some would, the guy I call the little fat one in there is pretty close to a guy that I actually worked with there. I have a feeling like he'd be bringing it to work and accusing the other ones of being particular characters in the book and pointing it out to him and having good fun with it. So I think it just depends. Because some of the characters would be kind of obvious to him in terms of who inspired them, I think they may get into some people's skin. I don't know.
And just an aside, I think that, you know, some of this, at one point we had an exhibit here and I quoted someone from an oral history interview that I had done with him. And he didn't like the quote because of the fact that the grammar that he used in the specific quote was not the way that he wanted to be portrayed.
I see.
So I think that it's interesting. One aside as well is that I've seen some people who have looked at fiction like yours, and they'll turn around and say, well, you know, that's not a real depiction because in reality it's so much worse than that.
That they would
you know, take a different tack than believing somehow that this was kind of naturalistic and kind of qualitative research in its own way.
Right.
Instead would argue that what you've done is you've sugarcoated in a way the way that maybe some of those reactions, some of the talk would have, where it would have gone or whatever.
I think so. And I think that was, you know, I took, I guess, maybe some license with it. I think, no, there were, and I have to some degree, depending, I think while building the narrative, there are certain aspects of the narrative that I was looking to achieve that readers may have been distracted from had I, in certain moments, saturated it to the point that it felt like sometimes when you'd be working there and offensiveness ensues, if, depending on the conversation, you know, people are talking. There is one spot that I didn't read that goes beyond any of the stuff that I read here today, and that was the one that made me cringe a little bit thinking of my mom reading it, and it was kind of a typical lunchtime conversation for some of the people that I've worked with in various jobs. You know, it's not that far removed from the eighth grade lunch table that I would sit at Catholic school. And so in terms of the stuff that, you know, stuff that we really didn't understand, but that people were, guys were plenty proud to talk about and bring up. And I didn't want it to have, I didn't want it to seem like a big eighth grade lunch table.
Other questions or comments? One thing that I want to raise with you, and maybe other people might be interested in your reaction on this too, is that when I worked in the paper mill, I knew I was leaving. And like you said, and so the one thing that happened when I left is that someone put a poem on my time card, one of my coworkers. And what he said in the poem, it's just a little rhyme, and it was, here we are and here we'll stay, dreams of grandeur, feet of clay. Okay? And I think that there's this whole notion of, in effect, it's different if you're in it rather than out of it.
Absolutely.
And that, you know, sense of relief, and maybe that we might write differently. This is a tension that runs through the whole notion of labor fiction or working fiction, because of the fact that is it an inside or outsider?
Who's writing it? Who's telling the story?
And who's the audience, in effect?
Right.
And should we be surprised that auto workers might not paint auto plants, but instead paint kittens when they get home? Right. And it can be very, very different in its own fashion, depending on how you view yourself.
Right. And while you're sitting in your, you know, faculty office and you're thinking of stories that you want to write, what makes sense that you can romanticize your that time you spent on the railroad, you know, mm-hmm. as a it's something I think about. I think that I was part of the first generation to go to college, and so the people, you know, people in my own family and people that I grew up around with the other character I write about, you know, this old coal miner, and I've never set foot in a coal mine, even to take a tour, you know, but I still want to tell that story, and I think that there's still stories I'm aware of and stories that I think are important to tell if you can tell them from some sort of authentic place. But anyway, to what you brought up, that's something that I think I tried to be mindful of as I wrote this, and I didn't want to write it from the point of view of a railroader who had been there for 15 years and who was looking down the road at 15 more years, because I didn't think that I could. There's other fiction writers who maybe could accomplish that if they had the same circumstances as me. I didn't think I could. I wanted to write from a genuine place, and for me, that was getting the character kind of close to where I had been, you know. As I didn't put in here at the end, he gets a graduate assistantship, but that was, you know, that's, so I didn't go that far, but I didn't want to pretend either like I knew the emotional truth of plugging along for decades, not, you know.
Well, and I think that it's also interesting, just as an aside, that in the one piece of other short fiction that you're using, you know, you're talking about Guatemalan laborers, in effect, in the United States. Because, see, one thing that labor and working class fiction has been accused of is being historical fiction rather than contemporary fiction.
Right.
Because somehow many of these jobs are no longer what the majority, quote unquote, of people do. Or there's a wonderful New Yorker cartoon that showed a child sitting on his father's lap, and the father is responding, and he said, "Labor? I think that you were one quarter labor on your mother's side." Okay, so there's a whole notion of the abstraction of physical labor, and the fact that other people do it instead.
Right.
So Mexicans, Guatemalans, whoever.
Right.
So I think that you're really capturing that by talking about them in effect now in the town, right?
Right, and that's another one that's autobiographical, more or less. I loved going to the new, I don't know if I should say I loved it. I would often go to these little corner stores that popped up around where I had come from, and it was there's a sizable Latino minority locally back home, but they almost all happen to be Guatemalan, and I love going to these stores because I think I was reaching for some kind of connection that had become distant to my grandparents' experience.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandparents and great-grandparents, I never knew my great-grandparents, but I think I've had that sense in going in those places of trying to reach for it a little bit and realizing that I'm kind of removed from that now.
Mm-hmm.
Not kind of, I am removed from that now, but you know, whether I, anyway.
Well, let's give James a round of applause. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And we'll see you all next week for Lou Martin talking about Blair Mountain.